Well, now it's my very great pleasure to introduce Dr. Leonard Peikoff, who has been the lead speaker at TJS in each of its four conferences, and who is probably the best lecturer I am aware of inside or outside of objectivism. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This time around, my overall topic is moral virtue. I want to present to you three issues under this general heading, taken with a variety of ad lib elaborations from my forthcoming book. And the three topics are justice, the evil of the initiation of force, and independence. These are covered along with other issues in one very long chapter in my book entitled Virtue, which is chapter 8 out of 13. It itself is well over 100 pages. It's the longest chapter in the book and the one from which I may say I myself learned the most, to my surprise, because I would not have expected that in projecting the book. I want to begin today by stating I forgot to motivate you. I always motivate an audience, and it occurred to me driving over here I didn't prepare any motivation, but I figured that any objectivist audience is already motivated to go into the substance of ethics. If you needed a motivation, you couldn't possibly have paid the fee. So I'm plunging right in. I want to begin by stating the context established in the previous chapters of the book, which I'm going to have to take for granted today and for the rest of this week. Chapters 1 through 5 cover all of the key points of metaphysics and epistemology. That's taken for granted. Chapter 6 is devoted entirely to the objectivist view of man, his metaphysical nature. Chapter 7, the one immediately preceding moral virtue, is called The Good, and it deals with the fundamentals of ethics. Basically, to refresh your knowledge, it has four subdivisions, or four topics that it includes, chapter 7. Life as the standard, rationality as the fundamental virtue, the issue of egoism, and value as being objective rather than intrinsic or subjective. So all that material is taken for granted, and now we get hierarchically to virtue. Now, of course, there's a slight overlap in calling this chapter virtue because rationality, the basic virtue, is already covered under the foundations of ethics. I found that you simply could not separate the virtue of rationality from the fundamentals of ethics. So I really mean by the chapter title virtue, the derivative virtues. And then the chapter, for your information, ends on the topic of the evil of force, which I regard as an all-encompassing vice. In other words, it's not merely the antonym or opposite of a given virtue, but the destruction of everyone and of all of them. In my opinion, the initiation of force is the only evil, therefore, which deserves and requires a separate treatment rather than merely being intrinsic to any one virtue. Now, if I had all the time in the world, I would go through the various virtues separately, and then I would conclude our mini course this week as I did the chapter with the issue of force. But I had to choose for the Jefferson School. So I picked two virtues, justice and independence, as of some special interest to this audience. In part, I didn't want to repeat what I covered here 2 years ago or anything that I've covered in lectures elsewhere. And I also chose to include force because I have a few interesting things to say about it, in my opinion anyway. Now, I'm changing the order in the book for the purpose of these lectures. In the lectures this week, the order will be justice today, force tomorrow, and then on Thursday, independence. The all-purpose question period on any aspect of objectivism will be on Saturday. Now, the reason for the order I've chosen, I will reveal in due course. It has to do with a certain surprise that I want to spring on you in regard to independence. So I'm saving the best, in effect, for the last. I have a new epistemological insight that came to me in writing Independence, an insight that to me is more interesting than the issue of independence. And that is what I really want to cover when we get to the finale this week on Thursday. Now, we must remember, before we plunge into the discussion of a specific virtue such as justice, that all the virtues are interrelated. They are all expressions of rationality. They are therefore all logically interconnected, both in philosophic theory and in actual practice. None can be fully validated in isolation, apart from the others. Nor can a man practice any of them consistently while ignoring or cheating on the others. So in defining a series of distinct virtues, Ayn Rand is deliberately abstracting. In other words, separating out for purposes of specialized study elements of a single unified whole. What is important about objectivism, however, is the whole. In other words, not disconnected rules or virtues, but a total integrated way of life, each aspect of which necessarily involves every one of the others. Now, in general terms, as I presume you know, the essence of the objectivist way of life is a man's recognition of reality, his adherence to reality. And this stands in direct contrast to any primacy of consciousness approach to ethics. In the primacy of consciousness approach, virtue consists in allegiance to consciousness, allegiance to the ruling consciousness, such as God or society. And so you get the Christian idea that loving God is the highest virtue, or the social idea that conformity to society is the highest virtue. In the objectivist approach, of course, the primacy of existence approach, by contrast, virtue consists in a relationship between man's consciousness and existence. It consists in recognizing certain metaphysical facts and then in acting accordingly. And the various virtues are differentiated from one another according to the particular facts they identify. Now, as you all know, in Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand defines how many major derivative virtues, derivatives of the virtue of rationality. Six. And they are independence, integrity, honesty, justice, productiveness, and pride. Now, Ms. Rand did not regard this list, because I asked her, as necessarily exhaustive. Nor did she think the order of the items as she presented them in Galt's speech was logically mandatory. Her concern was not to cover systematically every nuance or specialized application of virtue, but to identify the essentials of rationality in the crucial areas of human life. This, in effect, is the minimum moral knowledge needed by a man if he wishes to follow reason consistently as a matter of principle in his daily choices and actions. Now, with that preamble, let's go straight to justice. Now, my book is organized in such a way that every chapter has a title, and then every key sequence within the book has, in caps, a subhead, which captures the essence of the material in the form of one essential proposition. And the result is that when the book is finally published, there'll be an itemized table of contents, so you will in effect have all the master ideas of objectivism hierarchically structured in one gigantic table of contents, like a master list of the whole philosophy in three or four pages. Thank you. The subheads were a lot of work to decide what requires one and what is just a detail of another. It was a lot of agony in what order. And they are not synonymous with definitions, as you'll see in an instant, because the subhead of this particular one is justice as rationality in the evaluation of men. Now I'm going to begin with a definition of justice. This is my own words, but obviously Ayn Rand's viewpoint and ideas. Justice is the virtue of judging men's character and conduct objectively, and of acting accordingly, comma. Granting to each man that which he deserves. Let me repeat that. Justice is the virtue of judging men's character and conduct objectively and of acting accordingly, granting to each man that which he deserves. Now, our whole discussion will consist, in effect, of explaining and validating this proposition. And let me first give you a wider context or a wider perspective from which to zero in on the topic of justice. In order to achieve your values in any field, you must choose among alternatives according to your purpose. And this requires that you know and judge rationally the things around you. This applies even to the humblest undertakings, such as picking out the wardrobe you're going to wear today, or furnishing the spare room in your home, or even selecting a spot for a picnic some afternoon. And exactly the same policy, necessity, and principle apply in your dealings with men too. Men generically, including women. The necessity of choice and of rational judgment is especially urgent in regard to the human realm because the differences among men are incomparably more momentous than those among shirts, sofas, or parks. Men are beings of self-made soul. They have the faculty of volition with everything this implies. The wrong shirt can ruin your appearance. The wrong man can kill you. This shirt was not deliberately worn to make that point. The science that defines a criterion for evaluating volitional beings is morality. To deal properly with men, therefore, it is essential that one determine their relationship to the laws of morality, i.e., that one pronounce moral judgment. Now, morality, I assume you know, is concerned with a man's fundamental values. Moral judgment, therefore, enables you to know the essence that actuates a person. It identifies the principle shaping his character and the whole course of his action. In the objectivist approach, moral judgment penetrates to the root principle, the one governing a man's use of the faculty of volition as such. It distinguishes, moral judgment that is, distinguishes the men who choose to recognize reality from the men who choose to defy it. Such knowledge is necessary on practical grounds in order to plan your own actions and protect your interests. If a man is good by the objectivist standard, in other words, if he's rational, honest, productive, then other things being equal, you can expect to attain values in your dealings with him. If and to the extent that a man is evil, however, in other words, irrational, dishonest, parasitical, you can expect from any dealings with him not values, but loss, frustration, or destruction. The policy of pronouncing moral judgment is like a policy of human prospecting while wearing a coat of armor or a bulletproof vest. It's a process of methodically seeking out and cherishing the virtuous traits one needs or desires in others, such as effort, courage, idealism, while at the same time being alert to the opposites of these traits and to their destructive potential. Now contrast that with the policy of moral neutrality. The moral neutralist is one who deliberately blinds himself to men's virtues and vices. He refrains equally from admiration or dismay, praise or blame. Such a person does not wipe out the moral facts thereby. What he does do is deny the role of morality in man's life, subvert his own character, and wipe out his power to deal with other men on the basis of objective principle. The result is to consign his human relationships to the realm of chance, and to do something which is even worse: willfully to deprive the good among men of his sanction and support while becoming a tacit ally of the evil. In other words, while leaving that evil uncensored and unopposed, free to continue its course of destruction. In other words, the refusal to judge like any kind of agnosticism is itself the taking of a stand. In this case, a profoundly immoral one. And I'll quote briefly from Ms. Rand in The Virtue of Selfishness. Quote, when your impartial attitude declares in effect that neither the good nor the evil may expect anything from you, whom do you betray and whom do you encourage? So long as men have to make choices, there is no escape from moral values. So long as moral values are at stake, no moral neutrality is possible. To abstain from condemning a torturer is to become an accessory to the torture and murder of his victims, unquote. And in one brief sentence, as she summarizes it in Atlas, quote, only the good can lose by a default of justice, and only the evil can profit, unquote. Now, justice does more than protect a man in his direct personal dealings with others. Since the virtuous traits of others are an enormous value to you, whether you deal directly and personally with a given man or not, the principle of justice also protects your survival more broadly. It works to sustain all the men who think and who support human existence while chastening and counteracting their antipodes. The principle of injustice achieves the opposite result. In one form or another, it works to support the destroyers among men while undermining the thinkers and producers. Now, here is, in my opinion, a good new formulation. I have to say in my opinion, because it's a compliment to myself, but nevertheless, I think it's a good statement. Justice, in essence, is the policy of preserving those who preserve life. It is allegiance to those who have sworn allegiance to life. And it is therefore a virtue inherent in and fundamental to the morality of life. Now you see why we anathematize the biblical view, judge not that ye be not judged. And why the objectivist policy, as Ayn Rand put it, is judge and be prepared to be judged. If man's life is the standard, then each individual must, as a matter of principle, identify the moral status of every person, issue, and event within the field of his concerns, and then guide his actions accordingly. And what does it mean to guide your actions accordingly? Well, we'll discuss that at some length shortly, but for now, a summary anticipatory statement, it means deal with and or sanction only men who are virtuous. In mixed cases, you know, part good, part evil, sanction only the virtuous element within a man. And in regard to men who are vicious, condemn and, as far as possible, shun them. This is the basic mandate of the virtue of justice. I say as far as possible shun them because what if you go to college, for instance? You just can't shun them and get a degree. Now, the subhead in our discussion of justice was rationality in the evaluation of men. And I have so far only been discussing moral judgment, so I want to note here that moral judgment is not the only form of evaluating men. Moral values are the values that shape all of a man's behavior. But on their basis, many specialized kinds of value are defined. Intellectual value, aesthetic value, economic value, athletic value, etc. Such values, too, must be judged objectively, and their possessors or creators treated appropriately. So the virtue of justice has many applications which do not involve moral appraisal as such. But the precondition of all these derivative forms of evaluation is moral evaluation. And moral evaluation also indicates the pattern of the process of justice in any of its forms. And that is why I am restricting myself here and in the book to justice qua moral judgment, which is justice in its fundamental embodiment. Now, every virtue, justice included, has two aspects or sides, an intellectual and an existential side. Why is that? What fact about man makes it necessary for every virtue to have two aspects? Man is an integrated union of mind and body. He has two forms of choice. Choice to direct his consciousness in a certain fashion, and then choice to make his action follow from his consciousness or not. And therefore, every virtue has its intellectual side, the form of the process of consciousness it mandates, and then correspondingly the type of action that should derive from it. So let's study these in order. First, justice intellectually. Intellectually, justice consists in the systematic application of reason to the field of one's moral estimates. Of course, you technically have to say moral or other estimates because of all these other types of value, but we're restricting ourselves to moral. I say justice intellectually, to repeat, is the systematic application of reason to the field of one's moral estimates. The book is coming out within 2 years, so if you want to just enjoy it and not take notes, you'll have it. Now, this type of judgment is a demanding responsibility. It involves not unthinking condemnation or unthinking approval, but a methodical process of cognition. The same process in essence that one employs in regard to inanimate nature. In judging an individual's moral character, the just man follows the same epistemological principles as a scientist and is ruled by the same single-minded concern to discover what is the truth. And this in turn requires two steps, still within the intellectual side of justice. First, one must identify the facts of a given case. Then one must evaluate them by reference to objective moral principles. First, the facts, then the evaluation by reference to objective principles. Well, let's start with the first one first. In every process of justice, one must begin as a juror, struggling to grasp the relevant facts. Is the man in the dock a murderer, the juror has to ask, or is he the innocent victim of an error or a frame-up? Similarly, does your friend, as an acquaintance has just suggested to you, malign you behind your back, or is the accusation mistaken, or perhaps even malicious? Did your child's teacher punish him for no reason, as your child insists, or was there a reason? Of the candidates you are considering for a promotion at work, which one is the most reliable, the most honest, the most productive? In short, what are a man's attributes or actions? To be just, this is the kind of question you have to answer first, taking into account all the evidence available and assuming that it's sufficient to reach a determination. What would injustice on this count consist of? Any indulgence in emotionalism, any form of being influenced in one's factual conclusions by considerations other than fact, for instance, by prejudice or by favoritism. This is where the blindfolded statue that symbolizes justice is very relevant. That blindfold does not mean the statue is blind to reality. What the blindfold shuts out is any feeling detached from the facts of reality, whether the feeling be desire or fear, pity or hope, hatred or love. What it shuts out is the subjective and the arbitrary, leaving the individual free to exercise a purely rational process of cognition. Now you may ask, how much time and effort should I spend on inquiry of this kind? And the answer, as with so many such questions are, is it depends on the context. As a general rule, in life as in law, it is proper to assume that a person is innocent of wrongdoing until proven guilty. So if you want only to buy a loaf of bread from a man, no special assessment of the grocer is indicated. Absent information that he is trafficking in illicit or tainted goods, you may legitimately assume that the man is reputable. As the relationship that you contemplate becomes more important, fateful, or intimate, however, if you're a juror in court, say, or you want to invite a man to become your business partner or the tutor and companion of your child, then obviously deliberate study and a more detailed judgment does become necessary. Now, another clarification. Moral judgment does not mean nor include psychologizing. The facts which one seeks in order to reach a moral assessment are a man's actions, his statements, his ideas, his conscious mental processes and convictions, and that which flows directly from them. In other words, one seeks that which is within the man's direct volitional control and which is objectively ascertainable by any rational observer of his behavior. To put the point negatively, you do not, in passing moral judgment, you do not seek out subconscious contents, motives, or problems, which may not even be known by the individual in question, and which in any event can be diagnosed only by a qualified psychologist or psychiatrist. Now, we're leaving aside psychotics here. Other than them, men are conscious, responsible beings who must be treated as such. They are not helpless products of psychopathology to be excused or condemned on the grounds of hidden demons. Some men are actually healthy. They have no inner demons. But even a neurotic retains his sovereignty. Despite his anxieties and his defense mechanisms, he retains the power to perceive reality and to control his actions. If he loses that, he is psychotic. His psychological problems, therefore, are his concern, not other people's. Until and unless what? He allows his problems to materialize in the form of overt irrationality, in which case it is the overt behavior that other people have to observe and judge. So what you need to know in order to appraise a man morally is not what did his mother say and do to him when he was three, but rather what does he say and do now? And for elaboration on that, I refer you to the Voice of Reason, the article, The Psychology of Psychologizing, which is a very important article on moral judgment by Ayn Rand, which has been neglected in the sheer accident of not having been anthologized until just recently. All right, now assuming we've ascertained the relevant facts in a case. Let's go to the next step of justice, which I said was to evaluate them by reference to objective moral principles. Now, this is a continuation of the same primacy of existence orientation that dictated the initial fact-gathering stage, and it is essential to the virtue of justice. There is no sense and no morality in a judge carefully gathering the facts and then reaching his verdict by arbitrary feeling. That would be exactly comparable to a physician scrupulously collecting medical data and then borrowing his diagnosis from the local witch doctor. Now, there are many forms of evaluative subjectivism. One, perhaps the most common, The most common form is to judge others while upholding no explicit moral principles at all. Either because you have never bothered to consider the subject, which is the average non-intellectual person, or because you explicitly repudiate all moral absolutes, which is the average professor. Now, judges of this sort praise or condemn, quote, because I feel like it, without reference to reality. So their policy discards both justice and practicality. Their verdict is detached from the actual nature and deserts of the individual who is being judged. Now, in talking about justice, you must use the word desert. That's one S. And it means that which a person deserves. With two S's is what you have after dinner. Their verdict, I say, is detached from the actual nature and deserts of the individual who is being judged, and as a result, loses any claim to being considered a rational guide to action. Now, here's another form of evaluative subjectivism, which involves having explicit moral principles and applying them carefully. The only trouble is the principles are themselves non-objective. Suppose, for example, you first determine by painstaking investigation that your friend that we referred to is guilty of maligning you. So you got the facts. And you then proceed to overlook it, or even to praise him morally, by reference to some principle such as, you must love those who despitefully use and persecute you. Or, it is good if others wound your vanity. It teaches humility. Now, this kind of moral judgment is the explicit application of a principle, but it also discards the virtue of justice. Because in this case, the abstract evaluative criterion is detached from the facts of reality that make moral principles and judgments necessary. If you use a principle such as love those who despitefully use and persecute you, to judge, your principle ignores and contradicts the requirements of man's life. And so the result is an act of injustice with its consequences. If you embrace your hypocritical friend, for instance, that does not serve to change his behavior or to protect you from him. On the contrary, it's a form of rationalizing and rewarding his corruption while imperiling your own future interests. If you define good and evil in terms of irrational principles and then treat men accordingly, your policy produces only destruction. Now, some further clarifications with regard to making moral judgments. You have to bear in mind that there can be no such thing as a universal estimate of men. There is no universal estimate of men if you are rational. Since the moral is the volitional, there can be no rule to the effect that all men are necessarily evil, good, or mixed. Of course, at any given moment, all of them may choose to be, but there's no rule that they have to be. The mixed condition, of course, is by far the most common one today, thanks to the ideas which are now dominant. But this does not justify any extrapolation to the species. It does not justify universal denunciation. You know, all men are morally black. Nor does it justify the mealy-mouthed offshoot of such denunciation. Universal middle-of-the-roadism, such as all men are gray, with its twin corollaries, all embracing whitewash, there's some good in the worst of us, and all embracing sneer, there's some bad in the best of us. Now, the answer to all of this is that immoral bromides cannot replace moral judgment. They do not nullify one's responsibility to distinguish good men from evil. Nor do they relieve one of the painful necessity of distinguishing within the mixed or gray soul the constituent elements of black and white, of vice and virtue. Because gray, after all, is nothing but a mixture of these two elements. Now, I say painful necessity because it is relatively simple, if your principles are rational, to identify the pure cases, the heroes and monsters among men. The gray cases, however, typically present arduous problems in moral evaluation. Which element you have to try to determine rules which aspect of a mixed person's character. For instance, is he virtuous? I'm simplifying into the indicator pattern. Is he virtuous at work, but demonic in his personal life? Or how does the black and white break up here? Which, if either, is more basic? How stable is their current pattern of coexistence? And, above all, assuming that a relationship with the person is necessary and proper, how can you arrange to deal with the white side while not being vulnerable to the depredations of the black? Now, in practical life, such questions are often vital, and no snap judgment, like everybody's gray, everybody's black, can answer them. Only a dispassionate, meticulous process of justice can do it. All right, let's sum up the intellectual side of justice. Like all virtues, it's an aspect of the proper relationship between one's consciousness and existence. Justice is fidelity to reality in the field of human assessment, both in regard to facts and to values. Fidelity to reality in the field of human assessment, both in regard to facts, that's the first stage, and to values, that's the issue of the judgment has to be objective moral principles. And this is the full meaning of Judge Narragansett's statement in Atlas Shrugged. Justice is the act of acknowledging that which exists. Which, when you think about it, that's all there is to say. And that's true of everything Ayn Rand wrote. After you think a whole volume, you see that she already said the whole thing in one sentence. Injustice, by contrast, like all vices, is a form of evading reality. It consists in faking the character not of nature, but of men. Now, I can't resist a spot of polemics, although I'm getting much better here at weeding out polemics, but now and again I can't resist. There is no greater inducement to the evasion of injustice, that is, that to injustice, than the ethics of, guess what? Altruism. And it does it in countless ways. First, altruism inverts moral judgment, turns it upside down, teaches people to admire self-sacrifice and to belittle the exponents of self-preservation as low or evil. Then, since the theory can't be practiced consistently, it leads people to fear the process of moral judgment and even hate it. And so you hear people say that moral judgment is cruel and unloving. A good man is really not good, they say, he's lucky. And an evil man or group is really not evil. And here are the two most famous popular bromides are, he couldn't help it, they didn't mean it. At the same time, since moral evaluation can't be avoided, and since altruism does uphold an impossible standard, the theory prompts people, when they do judge, to condemn everybody indiscriminately. Now, all of these altruist policies, inversion, neutrality, and sweeping condemnation, defy the virtue of justice separately, let alone together. all represent faking on the grand scale and therefore work to promote the evil at the expense of the good. If we take a concrete example of the three, it is no obstacle to the concentration camp guard and no solace to his victim if one defines torture as virtue. That would be the inversion. Or if one averts one's gaze, that would be neutrality. Or if one engages in the sweeping condemnation, criticizing both men, torturer and victim alike, as gray, insisting in defiance of all fact that there must be some virtue in the whip-wielding fiend and some corruption in the writhing body at his feet. All right, now we come back to the positive. And I want to turn now to justice in the realm of action, which I've already said consists in granting to each man that which he deserves. What does a man deserve? And don't tell me what's coming to him, because what's coming to him? We have to start with the definition, and in this case I found an excellent one in the Oxford English Dictionary. To deserve is, quote, to become worthy of recompense, comma, i.e. reward or punishment, comma, according to the good or ill of character or conduct. Now, this is not objectivism. This is the Oxford English Dictionary. But it's a good definition. To deserve is to become worthy of recompense, i.e. reward or punishment, according to the good or ill of character or conduct. Unquote. A reward, this is now I'm speaking again. A reward is a value offered to a man in payment for his virtue or achievement. It is a positive, such as praise and admiration, friendship or patronage, some special privilege or prerogative, a sum of money, etc., etc. A punishment is a deprivation or disvalue inflicted in payment for vice or fault. It is a negative, such as condemnation and contempt, the withholding of friendship or even outright ostracism, or some special loss of privilege, prerogative, or money. And of course, in criminal cases, that can include the loss of freedom or of life itself. Now, the recompense, the reward or punishment appropriate to a particular case, both in content and in dimensions and scale, must be determined contextually by reference to the nature and merits of the case. The principle, however, remains the same in all cases. Justice in action consists in requiting the positive, the good, in men with a positive, and the negative with a negative. I like that statement, so I'll repeat it. Justice in action consists in requiting the positive in men with a positive, and the negative with a negative. This is the essential moral truth in the Old Testament injunction, an eye for an eye, although that formulation addresses only justice to the evil. It is also the truth symbolized by the scale in the hands of the statue of justice, the scale whose two trays balance equal weights. One weight represents cause, the other, effect. One, a man's behavior, the other, the payment for it, payment commensurate with it. Now, all moral principles must be validated. What is the validation of this aspect of justice? That is, why must you requite the positive with the positive and the negative with the negative? Why? Even assuming you've correctly evaluated, you've identified the facts and you have evaluated them objectively, and this man is really rotten or vice versa, he's good. Why must you then do something in action? Why must men reward one kind and punish the other? Now, this is rhetorical because it takes a whole paragraph to answer. The validation goes back, as any proper validation ultimately has to the nature of reality itself. It is reality that gives rise to the need of morality and to the definition of virtue. And it is therefore a fact of reality that virtue, assuming a proper definition, is the policy that leads to value, pleasure, the positive, while vice is crowned by destruction, pain, the negative. This is not a fact that men can alter. Their only choice is to acknowledge the fact and make it a principle of their own actions, or to attempt to ignore or reverse it and suffer the consequences. Now, in this issue, it makes no difference whether they simply default, they fail to consider the issue because they didn't exercise the thought involved, or whether they are outright evaders who deliberately intend to violate justice. Whether by default or intention, the unjust policy means ultimately to visit deprivations on the men who are good while conferring values such as sanctions, support, trade, wealth on their antipodes. And that kind of policy places man-made rules in contempt of reality. It turns virtue into a liability and evil into an asset, thereby subverting moral action at the root and making man's life impossible. How many of you now have heard of the moral theory called retributivism? A meager show of hands. Well, that's a whole school of the history of philosophy that attempts to validate this aspect of justice, why you should punish the evil and reward the good. And it says, in essence, that a man must be recompensed for his actions as an absolute, independent of any consequences, simply because he deserves a certain treatment. So they stress the idea of desert. An evil man deserves a punishment as an absolute, no matter what the results. And conversely, a good man deserves a reward, although they don't stress virtue. Now, their opponents, they're called retributivists for the obvious reason that retribution is their rallying cry. Now, their opponents, who knows the name of their traditional opponents across the decades and centuries? They're called utilitarians, and they now, the utilitarians, control the criminal justice system. They reply that there are no absolutes, and that the decision to reward or punish a man must be made by reference not to objective deserts, but to consequences. And of course, they hasten to say we can never be certain, probable consequences. Now, in this war between retributivism and utilitarianism, we see the false alternative of what two basic wrong philosophies? Who can see them? With an I and an S. Intrinsicism versus subjectivism. The retributivists are arch intrinsicism. Thou shalt punish, period, no matter what and without any consequences, and not as a means to anything. As against, no, we have to judge the effects on the public welfare. How do you know that? I don't know. It's what I and the public, and John Dewey and all of our friends, feel is good for the public. So it's a specialized case applied to the validation of one aspect of justice of the issue of intrinsicism versus subjectivism. Now, of course, objectivism sweeps aside both of these completely. Desert, the concept of desert, is essential to justice. So on that point, the retributivists are correct. But desert is a moral concept, and morality is a means to an end. All virtues accordingly, justice included, must be validated by reference to consequences. So on that point, utilitarians are right. But consequences, and here we're talking about the long-range consequences of an action or a policy for human life, consequences are precisely that which can be predicted only by means of principles. And principles can function as such only if practiced as absolutes. So therefore, desert, as the one school insists, is an absolute. But only because, as the other school says, the test of virtue is its results. In other words, you see, here as elsewhere, it is senseless and utterly destructive to introduce a dichotomy between principle and life. That's another way of introducing the dichotomy between morality and practicality. And it's something that has utterly confused the whole subject of justice by professional philosophers in their treatment of it. Now let us turn to the question, continuing, specifying our discussion, what rewards and punishments do men deserve to receive from one another? What rewards and punishments do they deserve to receive from one another? And the answer is precisely what each man's rational self-interest requires that he grant. In other words, there is no conflict in this issue. There is no conflict between a man's proper moral expectation of you and that which your own selfish interest requires. Justice never demands a sacrifice of you. If you properly and rationally carry out what is to your interest, he will get every reward or punishment that justice mandates for him. Well, now what then do men deserve from you? First, that you reach objective moral estimates of them, which we know is, of course, required for your well-being. Then that you take these estimates seriously, using them as guides to your action and to your bestowal of values, including the emotional responses you offer to others and the human relationships you agree to undertake. You reach objective moral estimates. That's what they deserve, and that's what's in your interest. And then you take these estimates seriously, making them the guides to all of your relations to the people involved. Now, there is a crucial form. There are many forms of action here, but I can't give you a whole catalog of the forms of justice in action. But there is a crucial form of justice in action that I do want to discuss. I touched on it at the opening. Morality is man's motive power. There is therefore no spiritual reward that you can offer that is as consequential as your moral sanction. And no spiritual deprivation that you can inflict as harsh as the withholding of it. Now notice I say spiritual reward because there's a harsher deprivation than withholding your moral sanction. Cut off his head, but we're speaking here in spiritual terms. That's physical. And this is the one crucial form of justice in action that I want to stress. Now, first of all, reward precedes punishment in the objectivist hierarchy. The conventional view is that justice consists primarily in punishing the wicked. And of course, this view stems from the idea that evil is metaphysically powerful, while virtue is weak and impractical, and therefore the big thing is to mow down the evil. Now, in the objectivist philosophy, however, virtue is self-made efficacy, while vice is the attribute to be scorned as impractical. So for us, therefore, the order of priority is the reverse of the standard one. Justice consists first not in condemning, but in admiring. And then, if this is to be a virtue in action, then in expressing one's admiration in reality and in fighting for those whom one admires. It consists first in acknowledging the good. That means intellectually reaching an objective moral verdict, and then in action in defending the good, above all by making one's verdict known, speaking out, championing the men who are rational, praising them publicly and to their face if there is some context to indicate that doing so would be of value to the person rather than an unwelcome intrusion. The evil must be combated, but then it has to be brushed aside. What counts in life are the men who support life. They are the men who wage an unremitting struggle to achieve values. In our era, often a heroic struggle. They are the atlases whom mankind needs desperately, and who in turn desperately need the recognition, specifically the moral recognition to which they are entitled. They need to feel while carrying the world on their shoulders that they are living in a human society and that the burden is worth carrying. Otherwise, like the protagonists of Ayn Rand's novel, they too will shrug. It is important to tell Kant that he has rejected reality and is wrong. It is more important that Aristotle or Ayn Rand find someone who understands that he or she has recognized reality and is right. It is important to condemn the school that abuses a child's mind. It is more important to praise the teacher or the mother who, despite such schools, manages to bring up the child as a rational being. It is important that today's politicians be voted out of office, but they will merely be replaced by equivalents unless we find and cherish some candidates who uphold freedom and vote them in. It is important to the preservation of property rights that a robber be caught. It is more important to the same goal that the great industrialists not be vilified as robber barons. But somewhere hear the words, thank you. In all such instances, Atlas Shrugged is the model to follow. The book as a whole is an historic act of justice because it is an act of homage, a bestowal on the world's thinkers and creators of the recognition, the gratitude, the moral sanction, which they have rarely received but abundantly earned. Now, in regard to the evil that you meet, the corollary act of justice is the refusal to sanction it. This is a major reason why, insofar as one has a choice, one must boycott evil men, parenthetically, if we were dealing with politics, and nations. Dealing or trading with them not only benefits them concretely while exposing you to their machinations, it also implies that you regard them as safe, civilized, reputable, an implication that amounts to extending to the evil your moral approval and your encouragement for the future. Now, a clarification here. If anyone is tempted to be overzealous in this regard, to refuse to sanction evil does not necessarily involve personally accosting its representatives, if no specific purpose is served thereby. Justice does not require that a man volunteer unsolicited denunciations to random individuals. There is, however, one situation in which a man must speak up: when his own convictions or values are attacked in his presence, and his silence would objectively imply his endorsement of the speaker. Now, even in such a case, for instance, at a party, there is no need to make a speech to a person or a group if you regard them as uninterested in the issue or closed to reason. A simple, quiet, firm, "I do not agree," is very often all that is required, morally and practically. Now, please bear in mind here that the discussion presupposes that the dissenter is not in the power of the irrational, as he would be in a dictatorship, say, but not only in a dictatorship. Suppose he's in the class of a professor who solicits his opinion and then grades him down for disagreement, which does not happen as often as some students think, but does happen sometimes. In such situations, you have no obligation to speak out, no matter what anyone may infer from your silence. Justice cannot require that a man make himself a victim of someone else's evil. All right, so far we have been considering justice as it would apply to any kind of human relationship, even if one had no personal dealings with the man. If you were merely a cultural observer, say, or a juror in a law court. But now let us consider the virtue in a positive and personal context. What does justice consist of in cases where one man seeks a value, whether material or spiritual, from another? So we're narrowing our focus here to a positive personal context. Justice in this context is adherence to what principle defined by Ayn Rand with a T? The traitor principle. Now, in a sense, you could argue that every act of justice, even if you're simply a dispassionate cultural observer, is an act of trade. This is inherent in the fact that justice is a form of rationality, a response to something in reality, that a just response is a deserved response, not a caprice. Rewards and punishments are not baseless gifts or penalties. They are recompenses or payments. They are what one offers to a man in exchange for what one gets. So in any specific value-seeking relationship, therefore, whether the value in question that you're seeking is material or spiritual, the exponent of justice is the man who gives in return for what he receives, and who expects to receive in return for what he gives. He is the man who pays his own way and expects others to do likewise. He neither seeks something for nothing nor grants something for nothing. And that is the aspect of justice identified by the traitor principle. This principle states that if a man seeks a positive from another, he must gain title to it. In other words, come to deserve it by offering the appropriate payment. In other words, the two men must be traders, exchanging value for value by mutual consent to mutual benefit. Quoting Ayn Rand, a trader is a man who earns what he gets and does not give or take the undeserved, unquote. Now, the trader principle derives from and presupposes the foundations of the objectivist ethics. It rests above all on the role of reason in human survival and on the principle of egoism. If the mind, the individual's mind, is what makes the creation of values possible, and if man is not a sacrificial animal, then the individual has a right to demand payment for his values. Nor does any man or group have a right to override this right. Now, I'm leaving aside here the claims of children on their parents, but leaving that aside, no man has, by the mere fact of his existence, his needs, or his desires, a claim on the assets of other men. To deserve a positive of any kind, material or spiritual, is not an innate state or a primary. It is an effect to be achieved by enacting its cause. And the cause of coming to deserve something has to be a specific course of thought and action, a course in which one creates and or offers values. Parenthetically, one deserves a negative by virtue of defaulting on some responsibility of thought or action. Now, I am using the term earn to describe this process. So I use the term earn more specifically than the term deserve. If you look them up in the dictionary, you can lose yourself in a huge array of confusing usages. But I make a flat distinction. I use the term earn to name the process of enacting the cause. In other words, of coming to merit a certain recompense by means of engaging in the requisite course of behavior. So deserve is when you're in the state that something is coming to you. Earning is the active process of thought and or action in which you come to deserve something. And if we use that terminology, as I do in my book, we can say that in a rational philosophy, there is no such thing as an unearned desert. A man deserves from others that and only that which he earns. That is the essence of the trader principle. That's the approach to human relationships that follows from the objectivist foundation. Now, since there are no effects without causes and no values without virtues, there is, in Ayn Rand's words, no escape from justice. To quote a sentence from her, nothing can be unearned and unpaid for in the universe, neither in matter nor in spirit. And if the guilty do not pay, then the innocent have to pay it, unquote. Now, this latter is precisely the demand of those who reject the trader principle. I'm thinking of the people who claim that values are the product of God or society, and that the individual, therefore, owes unconditional service to his superior, which is God or society. Now, in this view, certain men, such as the needy, are called deserving in a new, invalid definition of the term. They, quote, deserve to receive values simply because they don't have them but want them. As a recompense for no effort or action, as a payment for no achievement, in exchange for nothing. In this approach, the concept deserved or desert is turned into a caprice. In other words, the concept is vitiated, it's nullified, and the virtue of justice is thereby swept aside. So, of course, today, logically enough, that's what's called social justice, which consists in expropriating the value creators among men in order to reward the non-creators. Now, in the material realm, the trader principle prohibits both robbery and beggary, seizing wealth by force or demanding it as charity. It requires that you pay people for the goods or services you seek from them. The same principle applies in the spiritual realm to issues such as esteem, admiration, friendship, love. Here, too, a man must deserve that which he seeks from others, and here, too, he can deserve it only by earning it, only by creating the values of character that make his relationship with others a trade. I assume you know Ayn Rand's view of love, so I won't quote the passage from her on this. In the objectivist approach, there can be no looters or moochers of the spirit either. There can be no attempt to gain a positive response by making threats or by exhibiting need, by practicing blackmail or by pleading for emotional alms, by inflicting pain on another individual or by upholding one's own pain as a claim. Both the giver and receiver of a positive response must function as independent equals, with no evasion and no victims, each person adhering to reality, each profiting from the relationship. Esteem or love as a response to an individual's value is an acknowledgement of facts. As such, it has a moral meaning for both parties and imposes a double responsibility. The lover must be rational, and so must the loved one. He or she must be the kind of self-made soul who has earned such a love. Now, it's obvious how this contrasts with the Sermon on the Mount, with the idea that we should love our neighbor regardless of desert. We should love men not because of their virtues and values, but apart from their character and even because of their vices. Love your enemies, etc. Now, this is love not as payment for joy, but as self-sacrifice. Not as a recompense to the good, but as a blank check to the evil. Not as an act of reason or of loyalty to man's life, but as the intentional rejection of reason and of life on earth. I think you're not susceptible to this particular fallacy, so I needn't elaborate it further. Now, just as a man's character traits must be greeted by a deserved response, so must a change in his traits. If a good man turns bad, one acknowledges reality by reversing one's former estimate of him. The same applies if a bad man turns good. Just as love must be earned, so must condemnation and forgiveness. Now, forgiveness is a subdivision under justice. Forgiveness is earned if the guilty party makes restitution to his victims, assuming this is applicable, and then demonstrates objectively, through word and deed alike, that he understands the roots of his moral breach, has reformed his character, and will not commit such wrong again. Forgiveness is unearned if the guilty party wants the victim simply to forget the breach, in other words, evade it, and forgive without cause, or if he offers as cause nothing but protestations of atonement, which the victim is expected to accept on faith. Now, in regard to minor moral lapses, it is not difficult for a person, if he chooses, to demonstrate the necessary understanding and moral change. But if the vice or crime is of any significance, such demonstration is no easy matter, and in many cases it is flatly impossible. When a man commits a sizable moral evil, such as a major robbery or dishonesty, to say nothing of countless worse crimes, it is difficult even to know what kind of evidence would be required to convince others that he has reformed. This problem is one of the many penalties of vice, and it is the responsibility of the, not of the good, but of the evil to try to solve it, assuming what is seldom, if ever, the case, that moral reform is what the evil man is seeking. Now, forgiveness, which is legitimate when earned, must be clearly distinguished from mercy. That's always wrong. If justice is the policy of identifying what a man deserves, then acting accordingly, mercy is the policy of identifying it and then not acting accordingly. In other words, lessening the appropriate punishment in a negative case or failing to impose any punishment. Mercy substitutes for justice a dose of the undeserved and does so in the name of pity or compassion. Of course, not pity for the innocent or the good, but for the perpetrators of evil, because the innocent man, or even the truly reformed wrongdoer, asks for justice, not mercy. He wants what is coming to him. Now, the practical consequences of mercy, I think, are obvious to you from the newspaper accounts of today's courtrooms, where criminals of all ages and types are righteously set free, not owing to any doubt about their actions or any objective mitigating circumstances, but as an act of compassion for so-called helpless products of society. Who gains by such an act? The criminal. Who loses? His victims, both the person he preyed on or the survivors, who conclude bitterly that there is no justice and that society takes the side of the evil, and the future victims whom the criminal, unpunished and undeterred, is now free to go after. Now, we often hear from Christians that requiting evil with good, you've heard that expression, works to melt the heart of the wicked. There is no evidence to support this claim. Now, let's define our terms here. To requite evil with good does not mean to strengthen the white element of a gray man by an act of deserved kindness directed to his better nature. That you're requiting good with good. The policy means to reward the black qua black. But the essence of the black is the attempt to cheat and sneak, to evade moral principles and get away with it, which is precisely what mercy or unearned forgiveness or causeless love or unlimited smiling diplomacy permits and encourages. No evildoer is going to be melted as long as his victims compete with one another in offering him their favors, their sanction, and their other cheek. Now, like all religions, Christianity is incompatible ultimately with every virtue. But it seems to take a special pride in its principled exhortation to injustice, particularly as applied to the spiritual realm. If men are to have any chance for a future, it is this aspect of the Christian ethics above all others. This demand at once brazen and mawkish for unearned love, unearned approval, unearned forgiveness that the West must reject in favor of a solemn commitment to his moral antithesis, the traitor principle. Now, if you'll give me 2 minutes more, I will conclude our discussion of justice with the most flagrant repudiation of it that can be imagined, egalitarianism, which is a Kantianized version of Christianity. Now, egalitarianism here does not mean that men should be equal before the law, or that men should be granted equal treatment in the sense of principal treatment, as against the injustices that flow from a double standard. The best, simplest definition of egalitarianism is equality supersedes justice. That's my definition. And in this view, the most heroic creator on earth and the most abysmal villain and every person and group in between should share equally in every value, from love to prestige to money to important jobs to college degrees to newspaper coverage to political power, regardless of what any individual deserves or earns or has not done, regardless of his character, his achievements, his ability, his talent, his flaws, his vices, his virtues. Now, for centuries, altruists have implied as much, but even the communists have been too civilized to admit it. Their heirs at last have no such reservations. Now, since it's obviously impossible to live by this philosophy, since men could not survive for the space of a year if the rewards of virtue were methodically siphoned in this way into the lap of the undeserving, the egalitarian proposal can have only one purpose and result: destruction. The purpose is not to benefit the evil, but to smash the good. And this is the particular form of injustice that Galt has in mind when he refers in his climactic speech to, quote, the collapse to full depravity, the black mass of the worship of death, the dedication of your consciousness to the destruction of existence, unquote. Mind you, that was written in the 40s, decades before it made the newspapers. Egalitarianism is the act, if we use the metaphor, of kicking the scale from the hands of the statue of justice while stripping off its blindfold, leaving men to be ruled not by ordinary prejudice, which would be bad enough, but by the most virulent kind, the prejudice that Ayn Rand identifies as hatred of the good for being the good. I referred you to her essay, The Age of Envy, for the many examples of this attitude. And of this kind of hatred, which is pursued by those who feel it not as a means to an end, but as a nihilistic rage for its own sake. If you who befriend and uphold the virtue of justice study this essay, The Age of Envy, you will understand more fully why you must pronounce moral judgment in whatever forum is open to you. Because if you don't make yourself heard, there is a professorial brigade that will. A brigade that is now eager to take over and pronounce its benediction on the annihilation of mankind. And on that rather apocalyptic note, I will conclude for today. Thank you. All right, we have a short question period. I'm sorry I went over, but I didn't start cutting until it was too late. At the back, yes.
I'd like to hear you speculate on what you think the psychology of a person is that makes them good for being good.
Do I have to repeat the question? Oh. What is my speculation on the psychology of a person who hates the good for being the good? I think I'll pass on that. First of all, part of my lecture was on making a sharp separation between moral judgment and psychologizing by amateurs, of which I am a tremendous example, that is to say, being an amateur in the field of psychology and psychological diagnosis. But also in her essay, The Age of Envy, Ayn Rand discusses at length a rational reconstruction of how this type of person develops, what his mind was programmed to from the time he was very young, and what kind of choices. And I'd rather cover new material here. I will never, in an off-the-cuff answer, equal her methodical analysis. Yes.
Given your claim of justice, what's the proper role of charity?
Charity, given my analysis of justice, what is the proper role of charity? Charity properly is a form of justice, which does not mean, which I gather is the intent of your question, is the beneficiary of charity entitled to it? Does he have a right to it? No. But that does not also mean that you are acting baselessly or unjustly. You give charity to a man only if he is, according to objectivism, only if he's needy through no fault of his own, he's an innocent victim, and no self-sacrifice is involved on your part. You give him a sum you can afford. You're giving it to him in the name of something positive about him, either actual virtues which he's attained, or if he's a stranger drowning, you give him the benefit of the doubt that there's something good about him simply because he's human and you don't know anything bad. But in either case, your charity is a reward which you are voluntarily choosing to give in acknowledgement of a positive, actual, or at least potential in him. So he doesn't deserve it in the sense that he could knock on your door and say, you know, you're obliged to acknowledge my virtue with this reward. But that doesn't alter the fact that if you give charity rationally, you're still basing it on a value, and in that broader sense, it is a just, rational action. It's a good question. Yes?
Ms. Rand wrote opposing capital punishment on the grounds that an innocent person might be accidentally killed, and you said that under certain circumstances that you might...
I would like to know where Ms. Rand wrote that. Ms. Rand, in my knowledge, never wrote as a flat statement and never said in any interview show that capital punishment should be abandoned. That question has dogged me now for years, and I'd like to know where the people get that. I happen to know from detailed discussion her view of that question, and her view is part moral and part epistemological. Her view was morally, if you could establish airtight objective rules of evidence, which is the task of philosophy of law, which she did not enter, and you could prove that so-and-so was a murderer, then absolutely without doubt he should be received capital punishment. She was a complete advocate of an eye for an eye and a life for a life, assuming there's no mitigating circumstances on the murderer's part, morally. Her only hesitation was that given the state of today's law, and given, you know, the tremendous subjectivism that permeates the whole culture and everybody's conclusions on everything, what if an innocent man, you know, were sentenced to death by a vindictive jury swayed by emotions and the whole legal system winked at it, although I think it always happens the other way around, not this way, but theoretically this is possible. What if this were to happen and then you find out later and it's too late? So she inclined to believe that at a certain point in the deterioration of society, unless you have absolutely airtight evidence, but even today, there's a lot of cases I could mention, and you read them in the paper, where the crime is committed on national TV. You know, you see the guy, Jack Ruby, for instance, pull the weapon. The idea of what if we made a mistake in cases like that is fantastic. So, it is not true that she opposed capital punishment. Somebody else. One per person. Yes.
Is there a difference or an addition to the principles dealing with individuals when you're how you're going to deal with groups? Does the principles of justice differ for dealing with groups?
There is no difference between the principle of justice in any application to an individual, a cluster, a group, or the totality of mankind. That does not mean that every unit or cluster of units within the human race deserves from you the same specifics. You people paid money and deserve and have earned a lecture from me. But if you come up to me after class and want another one in elaboration, I don't owe it to you. So the principle of justice is the same, but the application is different depending upon what the concretes of the situation is. But there, if you were trying to say, is there some universal rule demarcating what you owe to an individual as against a group within the framework of justice, I have no idea what it would consist of. Do you have a case in mind? Okay, well, you think about it, but offhand, I can't think of any. Now, we're going to go a couple minutes over with Dr. Reisman's permission, because I actually was given the floor 2.5 minutes late, so I'm not as I am not as far behind as it looks. What? Oh, okay, fine. Somebody, now, only Phil, all right, you may as well get your question. Yeah.
Sometimes it seems to me quite often it's a problem for objectivists. They may apply it wrongly, either too harshly or not harshly enough.
Which is the principle? I didn't hear that. That they're applying harshly.
Well, actually, your whole lecture, but judges have been applied and be prepared to be judged.
Oh, I see.
And I'm thinking about why sometimes objectivists that I know may apply that principle too harshly or too soft, and I'm wondering whether it has to do with the fact that sometimes you think you know to judge somebody and you're not aware that there are other contexts that you may not have. Such as you may not understand psychology very well. And so you'll judge an evil person as too innocent or more common.
I get the idea. The question is, why do so many objectivists apply the principle judge and be prepared to be judged improperly? That is, in the questioner's opinion, either too harshly or too softly. They either are too condemnatory or they're not condemnatory enough. This is, again, a psychological, not a philosophical question. So I can permit myself to be brief. I'm sure there are many different causes involved in many different individuals. Sometimes there are psychological factors and so on. But broadly speaking, as a philosopher, I'm entitled to speak in generalities because that's my profession. This is a reflection of the difficulty about which I've written in other contexts of assimilating objectivism, which is a revolutionary new philosophy. And many, many people with good intentions, leaving aside even the bad ones, come to objectivism and are completely programmed, unknown to themselves from childhood, to be receptive to an alien philosophy. And then they take objectivism and put it as the filling within the categories already established. Now, for instance, the typical person who is, quote, too harsh in moral judgment is an intrinsicist. He may have been brought up religiously or not, but he inclines to think on his deepest subconscious a moral judgment as being a series of rules. You must not sanction evil. You must hold a job. You must work for a living. You must tell the truth. So he takes the Ten Commandment approach, but he just substitutes the objectivist content. Well, then, of course, he has no way to identify context, no way to say, well, yes, you must hold a job, but I was just run over by a truck, so it isn't fair to expect me to go to work today. You know, it just, that's a silly example, but you get the idea. The over-harsh people tend to be intrinsicists. They haven't uprooted, usually, their religious upbringing. They've just turned objectivism into a religion. Now, the over-soft people are the subjectivist types. They don't like judgment. They feel that there's something irrational or over-emotional or unconnected to reality about any moral judgment. And since they're now going to be, quote, objective, they shun the whole phenomenon. That's a generous interpretation. Now, of course, you know, and I don't have to say it, because I've also recently written about it, that there are people whose claim to fame is precisely, I mean by claim to fame, what makes them tick is the desire to avoid moral judgment and be loved by everybody. But we're leaving out that type of individual. If a person tends to be over soft, really, and not just because you're over hard and judged by you he's over soft, but if he really is over soft, he's probably either got a subjectivist element, or, which is also very possible, he is reacting against too many intrinsicist type of objectivists. And he sees them going around denouncing right and left, and he says, I'm not going to be like that, therefore, I'm not going to judge at all. Or he doesn't say that exterior, but I'll bend over backwards before I judge. Now, these are not valid. Either of these are not valid. My mother once said something true, which is that two wrongs don't make a right. And the solution to all of the people who misapply moral judgment in the direction of judging overly harsh is not to misapply it by not judging harshly enough, but to be objective. Now, I've heard this across the whole range, not just of this topic, but this type of reaction. I know perfectly decent people who won't call themselves objectivists, although they agree with and understand objectivism. And on the grounds that so many people have called themselves objectivists that they think are wrong and no good, that they don't want to be identified with them. Now, I think that's a flat-out mistake. I don't think you should give the term objectivism away to the wrong exponents of it. You should, in a case like that, say, he isn't an objectivist, but I am. You see? And just as Ayn Rand says, all Peter Keating is not selfish, but Howard Roark is. Roark doesn't say, I've seen so many corrupt people using the term selfishness that I'll call myself, by some neologism or a new disciple of altruism. And the same thing applies to objectivism, and the same thing applies to justice and moral judgment. Now, George, if you were really right, we could take a couple more questions. Okay, yes. Not a lot of understanding.
This is really an epistemological question, actually, that does have an indirect link to the topic of ethical judgment. I was wondering if you knew any particular work either in process by yourself or written by Ayn Rand in particular or otherwise that dealt with the actual process of identification. In other words, looking at concrete symptoms.
Well, that really is out of left field, except you're attaching to the issue of identifying the facts about a person. But the question was, do I know a book or part of a book that deals with how to identify facts correctly, just in general? And my only answer to that is that is the entire subject matter of epistemology. So that's not one question. That is how, since all knowledge reduces to knowledge of fact, this is another way of asking, what are the processes by which to arrive at and validate knowledge of the world? And that is the entire subject of epistemology, and on that I definitely know a terrific book, and another one yet to come. Yeah. Your pardon? But you mean, do I have specific tips that I could give out of context? Not that I can think of.
But it's really as distinct from not necessarily the process of conceptualization, but the process of identifying a particular concrete and then matching to a given concept. For example, identifying whether something is actually just or unjust, et cetera.
Well, yeah, you're asking for, in effect, inductive reasoning, then. How do you know when a particular concept applies in a particular case? And the only thing I could do is either give you a whole discussion of what does objective thought consist of, what is logic, and that is in my book, or we'd have to then come down to particular examples. I don't know anything in between, so I'll have to pass on that for now. The key to the answer, which is as general as your question, but I'll allow myself that much, is you have to know the essence of the concept and the context conditioning the concrete. And if you take both of those into account, you can match them. But that in itself doesn't get you very far. Now, these are supposed to be one per person. None of those people have asked before on the left in the shadow. There.
I was wondering if you felt that there was one of the virtues that the other ones depended on, whereas you couldn't have, what they wouldn't be possible without at first the virtues coming to.
Is there one virtue more important than the others on which all depend?
Or that, like, you couldn't have integrity without honesty.
You can't have any virtue without all of them. The only one you can say is most important is rationality. But the reason you can say that is rationality is a broad generalization which subsumes all of the derivative virtues. You could not practice rationality without the derivative virtues or without any one of them, let alone all of them. And in fact, what I had in mind as an exercise, which is obviously academic, at the time, since I'm running already behind on the first day, if we had time left on Thursday, I was going to put six virtues in a hat, you know, the names, and just have someone from the audience draw two at random and show you that whichever two you picked, each one necessitated the other, and they would be impossible apart from the other. But right now, given the timing, I have my work cut out just to finish Independence on Thursday. But try that sometime at a party. You have them every night. You just pick out, for instance, pride and integrity, or justice and honesty. And you'll see right away, throw rationality into it, throw egoism in. And then if you want to really make it complex, throw in some epistemology too and pick out any two. That's how I was taught objectivism originally, not out of a hat. But we were given as an assignment to take two points widely removed and figure out the connection between them. That's what we did at parties, believe it or not. Yes, in the red.
In our book for a course, I came across a critique of this of the moral judgment argument. The book noticed that certain socioeconomic groups tend to produce more criminals than others. So how do you respond to that argument?
What's the argument?
That it's somehow not really connected to volition because, say, certain socioeconomic groups tend to produce more criminals than others.
Well, you know, you're saying if certain socioeconomic groups tend to produce more criminals than others, therefore man is not really volitional, therefore justice doesn't apply. Is that your argument?
Well, that's what the book argues.
Well, that's what you want me to answer?
Yes. Yes.
Well, there are many, many reasons why socioeconomic groups may have a, not a monopoly, but, you know, what do you call it when there's an oligopoly on crime, that have nothing to do with whether or not man has volition. One of the countless reasons could be if another group that runs newspapers and schools spends all their time telling the first group that they are helpless victims of depraved injustice and that the only way to get what's coming to them is to commit crimes. If you know which groups I'm talking about. If that is dinned into people's ears, there will certainly be a strong tendency for the recipient group to go out, march and riot in the streets. That will not prove determinism, but ideological corruption of their teachers. And the culprits, therefore, are not the socioeconomic group that you have in mind, not the poor or the black or whatever, but the people who are teaching them that the solution to their problems is not work, effort and freedom, but government handout or outright murder. In other words, it's the volition of the New York Times and Harvard University that is the culprit here, not the non-volition of the socioeconomic group in question. So even if the statistics were right and criminality was much more advanced among the poor or the black or the whichever, that would have nothing to do with volition. Or with justice, or with philosophy. It would only have to be a reflection on the corrupt philosophy of the people educating these groups. All right, I guess we have one more question, and then I've done, I've given you what you've earned today. I guess I shouldn't discriminate in the name of egalitarianism against the front row. Yeah.
I like what you said about in a mixed situation, think I'm a rank novice of objectivism, and the thing that I want to know is how do you behave when you can't do that, as in picking the president? Do you vote Republican, Democrat, write-in, or not at all?
Well,
to me, this is serious.
Yeah, it's serious. It's hopeless. The question is, I said sanction only the virtuous element in a mixed case. How does this apply in elections? Do you vote Republican, Democrat? What was your choice?
Write-in
or not at all. Well, write-in is a waste of time unless it's part of a movement, because George Washington is dead, and who else do you write in? So you can't certainly do it by voting a straight party line, because many Democrats are better than many Republicans, if the word better is not a stolen concept as applied to any politician. So it certainly can't be Republican or Democrat. You have to judge in each case by the context and situation at the time, what the alternatives are, and how depraved they are. The application in this case is, you have to have in your mind a line beyond which you say, I will not vote. The only moral thing is not to vote, because a vote is a sanction. It's not a sanction of the man's total views, because it's understood in a two-party system that both parties are coalitions going across a vast spectrum. And therefore, the act of voting for a man does not imply, objectively, that you sanction everything he believes. But what it does imply is that he does not, in your opinion, hold any view so monstrous or so profoundly anti-freedom that you still regard him as civilized enough to say, I'm content to have this man as president. That's the minimum. Now, there have been candidates of whom I've sat out whole elections because I couldn't say that about either of them. But there are many candidates miles away from objectivism, you know, that you wouldn't dream of thinking of as being objectivist or pro-freedom or anything, that I have voted for simply because I thought I saw some good, some bad, but not concentration camp level bad, and the opponent was that, you see. So you have to judge as best you can. Ladies and gentlemen, see you tomorrow. Thank you very much.